Hi, this is Daniel Garb of the Movies for CulturalMining.com and CIUT 89.5 FM. Enormous armored vehicles ply the streets of small town New Hampshire. Police are studying in military boot camps, and LA helicopters are surveilling the movements of everyone on the streets. Sounds like something out of RoboCop or Minority Report, but it's all happening now. Homeland Security is intentionally giving military weapons to civilian police forces across the United States. And they say, if you know what's good for you, do not resist. Do Not Resist is also the name of a new documentary about the deliberate militarization of U.S. police forces. It was directed by cinematographer and filmmaker Craig Atkinson and won Best Feature Documentary at the Tribeca Film Festival. This film had its international debut at Hot Docs in Toronto, and it's playing again this weekend. And I'm very pleased to have Craig here in the studio to tell us more about the militarization of police forces. Hey, Craig.
Hi.
Nice to meet you, and thanks for showing up.
It's so great to be here. Thanks for having us.
So let's start. What is Bill 1033?
Sure. So the 1033 program dates back almost three decades. And it was a program that allowed for the transfer from military organizations to domestic law enforcement. And the original idea was to use this surplus military equipment that's returning home from war. And the idea was, well, there's increasing threats in the United States. The police always cite one particular incident, which was the North Hollywood shooting, which they were totally outgunned for. And thus, they said that they needed more equipment to face this threat. And so the 1033 program was the mechanism by where the military could transfer legally the tools of war to domestic law enforcement.
So how is it manifests itself, especially post 9/11.
Sure. That's a great point, because what we realized looking back after finishing the film is that what we really started to film was the transition between the war on drugs and the war on terror. And originally, when people started to speak about the militarization of police post Ferguson, they were thinking about the armored vehicles, the tanks, the camouflage, the vests. But what we noticed in 2014 was the surveillance technology popular in the United States war against terror. Now that is trickling home from war, and now we see the surveillance technology. In fact, we spoke to one technology provider who was offering the same IBM platform that the NSA uses to collect emails. Well, he was giving that to police departments for a $1,000 a year subscription. And so that was a private company, but there's also military technology that's being made available to local law enforcement as well.
Okay, let's talk about the surveillance in a little while. But first, you mentioned Ferguson. So in Ferguson, Missouri, St. Louis County, a policeman killed Michael Brown. This led to very widespread protests. Mm-hmm. So can you talk about what people started noticing for the first time?
Sure. Well, here's the thing. In Ferguson, I spoke to a lot of people who weren't even out there for Michael Brown, but what they were out there for was a feeling of being constantly harassed in the community. And why they were being constantly harassed is because the police departments in the St. Louis County area use ticketing to raise a portion of their operating revenue. 17% of their operating revenue in Ferguson is from ticketing their citizens. There's surrounding communities that raise up to 50% of their operating revenue from ticketing citizens. One town right next to Ferguson, Jennings, lost a shopping center one year, and they lost $1 million worth of sales tax revenue. Well, wouldn't you know, the very next year, they raised $1 million more money from ticketing their citizens. And so what we saw in Ferguson was the boiling over point. It was the last straw. A lot of people said, you know what, Michael Brown doesn't really represent everything that we're fighting for. There's some questionable things that he did, and we don't stand behind those things, but we're just so sick and tired of walking down the street and getting a ticket for walking down the street, literally.
So this is the protesters' aim, but how did the police react?
Oh, well, in Ferguson, it was the SWAT team first, where a lot, and they weren't trained, so they didn't know how to use this equipment that they had been given. And instead of doing what most cities do, which might put out plainclothes officers and keep the SWAT team staged behind, well, here they had all of this equipment and no training, and so they met the protesters with the full force of what they had, almost like, look at these great tools that we get to try out now.
And tell me about the tools.
I mean, it was, the armored vehicles, which gives such an advantage to a police officer from a protest perspective. It's elevated. They had weapons trained on the protesters using their scopes almost as binoculars. And I noticed many times where there's like a flashlight at the end of the M4 rifle, and instead of using, a verbal command, they're pointing at people with the rifle to use a flashlight to indicate that they should move out of the way. So it was gross negligence across the board of actually how to tactically use these weapons. But they're given all these weapons without training, so it's not surprising that this type of thing would happen.
So where do the weapons come from? Who's giving it to them?
Sure. So, there's two avenues. There's the DOD, which actually transfers the surplus equipment.
That's the Department of Defense.
That's correct. But then the DHS offers grants to purchase new equipment from suppliers.
So that's the Department of Homeland Security.
Yes, exactly. So they would give a grant to a city council and say, hey, if you vote and approve this grant, then you can go buy a Bearcat, guns, high-powered rifles. And so there's two different mechanisms. One is surplus equipment and one is grants to purchase new equipment.
So a Bearcat is a ballistic engineered armored response counterattack trucks.
That's correct.
And these were designed for war. Is this designed for the Afghanistan or the Iraq war?
Sure, good question. Well, the Bearcat specifically was a company who used to make bank trucks, and they saw the trend in SWAT and said, hey, we can use this for SWAT teams, and they retrofitted their truck to service the SWAT industry that was coming up. That company actually has vehicles in, I think, about 92% of all major U.S. cities. But now that they've saturated
92%.
That's correct. And now that they've saturated the U.S. market, now they're selling to Saudi Arabia, to Qatar, to the Middle East, almost reverse of what the MRAP is doing, which is returning home from war after, MRAP is a mine-resistant, ambush-protected vehicle.
So why do we need mine-resistant vehicles in small towns?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that there'd be more of a case for a Bearcat because it is a vehicle that's designed on a Ford F-150 chassis, which is more suitable for roads. And there are, situations where you need police officers in protected vehicles. There's no questions about that. My whole concern is that they say they need it for these terrorist events, and then they go and raid houses for small amounts of narcotics.
Well, I wonder if you could talk about that. You went on a ride-along with a SWAT team.
Yes.
With the full armored regalia and the vehicles, yes, and the arms. So can, yes, you describe what happened?
Sure. We were in South Carolina, and they asked if we wanted to go on a raid after building a rapport with that department. And 15 minutes after we decided we were going to do this raid, we run into the house. They're breaking all the windows. It was supposed to be a drug kingpin. He was supposed to be there by himself. But in fact, it was a 22-year-old black college student who was there home with his family. His sister was there. A 4-month-old baby was in the house. And they smashed the windows, put everyone on the ground with this overwhelming force. And what did they find? Not kilos. They found a gram and a half of weed. A gram and a half of
weed.
In
Canada, that's practically legal now.
I'm sure most of the listeners have it in their pocket right now. Praise Canada.
And so the interesting thing for me was he's a landscape architect, or he's working in yards, and
yes,
he says, can you please take this money and pay the workers? I won't be able to get to them if you're taking me to jail.
Yes.
What happened?
Right. So the officers found the gram and a half of weed. That was enough to arrest them. So they arrested the young man. And then when they're going to put him in the paddy wagon, he says, hey, can you give this money to my boss because he's coming to buy lawnmowers today? And the cop says, basically, sure. And he hands over $876, the exact price that he's supposed to, or that he has to buy these lawnmowers. And the police officers decide to seize the money because they call it drug money. So here you have an individual who is trying to better themselves and create a legit business for themselves. And that money was taken. So the young man went to jail. He was released that night, but the money didn't come back.
So this is this weird situation where police forces are actually impoverished because they're not getting enough tax dollars coming in. So they have to resort to other methods. But at the same time, how much does one of those armored vehicles cost?
Sure. Great question. So it's a $250,000 price point for a Bearcat.
$250,000.
Correct. But the MRAPs are given for free. No cost to the department, just maintenance and then upkeep. And so it's very hard for departments to not accept a cool free tank.
And who pays for it?
Well, the American taxpayers originally paid about $1.2 million per MRAP. To be manufactured, to be sent overseas. As those, you know, return from home, what we saw in Red River Army Depot in Texas is literally fields, thousands of these trucks sitting and rotting and wasting. And it's no, you know, it's no wonder that communities in the United States are failing when we're spending all of our money to for these vehicles of war. But then now the police officers have to go and raise money for to be like the de facto tax collectors in their cities because the cities are failing. And you just see rows of these MRAPs in the field rotting, and they're 1.2 million. Well, if we spent our money more wisely, you wouldn't have to have communities that were failing than police officers that were going out to ticket citizens to raise their operating revenue. It just showed to me the full circle of how our country is failing.
Okay, let's talk about surveillance, because you have in LA aerial photographers, and tell me what are they doing?
So that particular section was a provider in Dayton, Ohio. He has worked in Captain, California, and a variety of other cities that most people in the United States have no idea that they've been operating in: Baltimore, Ferguson.
And what do they do?
And so essentially, this man, here we are again, tools returning home from war. He had a program in Fallujah called Angel Fire. They would fly Cessnas over Fallujah and watch people planting roadside bombs, and it obviously helped over time. Great use of the technology. Returning home from war, the gentleman said, well, this is a great application for domestic law enforcement. And so now he's retrofitted that technology and is flying a giant camera system over cities and recording the entire city. And if there's any crime, well, you just roll back the tape and see where the crime happened, and then roll it back further and see where the people lived, and then knock on their door and say, hey, we saw you on tape over here. So, you know, his argument is that, hey, you're in public. There's no expectation of privacy.
But there's no expectation of privacy online and in public now. So sure. Where is their privacy?
Sure. Right. Well, that's a good point. And the thing is, we're starting to create this world. Well, yes, you know, probably when you and I were growing up, there's no expectation of privacy, but you stepped out of your house and you weren't being surveilled from the sky. You know, and so like any other panopticon experiment, when you know you're being watched, your behavior changes. And I'm just concerned about the long-term approach or results of knowing that we're being surveilled and watched all the time.
Indoors and outdoors. Online and offline.
And we talked to technology providers that said, you heard of Google Earth? How about Google Earth inside? And they're trying to get police officers access to CCTV cameras in schools and everything, and just to have, you know, police officers have full informational awareness.
And finally, you have a criminologist who says you can determine a potential criminal by looking at their face. Could you talk about that?
Sure. Well,
this sounds like Minority Report.
Well, yeah. You know, we start to bump up against that type of thinking. And what he's doing is basically using data sets that we all have provided the internet, whether it be, you know, through our comments. I mean, who knows in the future, your Fitbit information. I mean, all these statistics to determine whether or not you're going to be a violent person in the future. And right now they're using it to release people from prison, determining what type of parole this person should get. But now they're also using it in LA to look at the database, and the algorithm scans the database, but then it scans all these Facebook posts and see if perhaps your thinking might be similar to a serial killer's thinking, or maybe someone who's on suicide. And wouldn't you know, are you doing okay? They might get you might get a preemptive visit.
Knock on your door.
Yeah.
But when the images you showed in the movie, it seemed to be whenever there was a African-American face came up, the crime side went high.
Sure.
Potential.
Sure.
So what is that?
Well, that's the other thing, is that he said that, you know, if we, you know, we have to also consider race, because people kill people like themselves. So from a very scientific measuring standpoint, that's a factor that he wants to incorporate to determine whether someone's going to be violent or not. And my concern, again, with this is that we're digitizing old ways of thinking. We're putting into algorithms old ways of thinking that maybe we should never, you know, crystallize as the greatest, you know, contribution of mankind in thinking. But now we're using that information to determine someone's future violence or potential for violence.
It's chilling.
I think so, too.
Thanks so much for talking with me. Craig Atkinson's shocking documentary, Do Not Resist, had its international premiere at Hot Docs, and you can see it this Saturday night. Go to Hot Docs. Shocking documentary, Do Not Resist, had its international premiere at Hot Docs. You can see it this Saturday night. Go to hotdocs.ca for details, or donotresistfilm.com for more information. This is Daniel Garb of the Movies each Friday morning on CIUT 89.5 FM and on my website, Cultural Mining.com.